Greetings once again to you, my fellow man. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. To another week. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to the program, where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. So glad to have you with us as we move into another action-packed broadcast hour as we go worldwide to the World Wide Web, unconstrained by the traditional bounds of broadcast media. Created a bit of a stir amongst the audience last week as I discussed the possibility of going on hiatus. Due to the fact that, I'm capable of being just as lazy as the next guy. Got an email, just a sampling of some of the concerns we received last week from our good friend Dave out in Los Angeles. He says, Doug, first, the Weekly Worldview pulls a Lazarus and is back from the dead. Now you're saying that the show might take an extended vacation again. Do I have to call Michael Jackson's doctor to revive the show? And I'm thinking, Dave, Michael Jackson's doctor is probably not the appropriate doctor you want to call if you want to revive anything. But maybe his tongue was firmly planted in his cheek, and he's just a fairly bright fellow making a fairly entertaining observation. He says, Doug, please at least consider turning your action-packed one-hour show into an action-packed half-hour show before completely ending it. Well, Dave, I can do neither. I can neither end it nor can I go a half hour because there's just too much, even in a week, every week, when my time is so constrained by the responsibilities of work and family, there's just too much news out there that I've got to get to. So the show goes on, worry not, fear not, but if you have not subscribed via Feedburner yet, please do so, so that we know you're out there, and we know that we're just not talking to the wall. Okay? Now, let's start with Barry Ho, and I often like to start with something a little bit more lighthearted, and we're going to do that. We're going to start with Barry Ho's first pitch out in St. Louis at the All-Star Game. Did everyone get a chance to see that? Who cares, right? It's the All-Star Game, which means nobody really cares, and it's Barry Ho, which means nobody in my audience really cares, but he did deliver the first pitch out there. According to the Associated Press, President Barack Obama delivered at the All-Star Game Tuesday night, the first pitch, biting his lip for a little extra zip. Yeah, wow, that rhymes. I wonder if they did that on purpose. I guess since we have our first black president, the news should start sounding like hip-hop. Biting his lip for a little extra zip, he fulfilled his modest goal of flinging the ceremonial first ball all the way to the plate on the fly. Now, the Fox television angle, according to the AP, cut off the catcher, first baseman Albert Pujols, as he caught the ball, and many people at Busch Stadium weren't completely sure that the ball made it all the way across the plate to the catcher. When Obama later visited the broadcast booth, a replay from the center field camera showed the ball made it home. And I didn't watch it live, I saw tape. And it was obvious that Albert Pujols had scooted up a little bit. In fact, the AP quotes him, I scooted up a little bit, but I think I was going to catch it in the air the whole way. That's what Albert Pujols says. Anyway, Obama looked, let's just say, less than W-ish when he threw out that first pitch. Now, I am not a big fan of George W. Bush. Anyone who's listened to the program knows that. But I've got to give props to George W. Bush, October of 2001, when he stepped out on the field at Yankee Stadium. We were all still in the grips of fear after the terrorist attacks had killed 3,000 of our fellow citizens. And the President of the United States walked into the middle of a large open area, a public place, and I got to give props to Bush. He threw a strike, all right? He looked like a manly man throwing the baseball. What does that have to do with anything of any relevance or importance? Maybe nothing. Maybe. But maybe there's something, ladies and gentlemen. The cracks in the facade are beginning to appear, in my humble opinion. Obama is beginning to stumble. Yes, this week, over this past week or 10 days, there was an ignominious clip a video clip of him tripping as he walked into the G8 or G12 or G25 or whatever G meeting he was at this past week or two. And then there was the incident where his teleprompter collapsed and crashed and burned in front of everyone. And a number of other small incidents that are beginning to tell me that the possibility exists that he has the potential to become a laughing stock. The 21st century's answer to Jimmy Carter, so to speak. It's possible. But the media, all of his friends, the liberals, the products of modern journalism school, they've got a lot invested. Maybe too much. Too much invested in Barry Ho to actually state and report on what is becoming obvious to those of us who are just moderately observant of the daily news. But you know, they had the same problem with Jimmy Carter, if you remember back. I know it goes back a ways. But eventually, you know, even Walter Cronkite was forced to report day by day the disasters and the failures and the embarrassments that became the Jimmy Carter presidency. There was just simply too many of them. Even Walt had to report the news. And the news was that the guy was a disaster. And, well, my fear is that Obama would probably have to screw the country up significantly worse before we're all allowed to notice the obvious, the fact that Barry Ho is a bozo, okay? Lord willing, it doesn't have to get to that level, a Carter-esque embarrassment to the whole country and the world. But I guess we're all going to live through it and see. Lord willing, if the Lord tarries. Now, speaking of baseball, I was throwing the baseball around yesterday on a beautiful Colorado Saturday afternoon out in the middle of our street with my 7-year-old daughter. Well, we weren't actually throwing a baseball, I have to be honest. We were throwing a tennis ball. And, you know, given the fact that she's 7 and she's a girl, I think that's okay. Some of her friends, associates, I should say, in the neighborhood, products of the public school, they joined the game, the game of catch that we were having. And we were throwing the ball out there and having a good old time. Several of the neighborhood children were fairly embarrassing in their Obama-esque delivery of the ball, and they weren't that great at catching the ball either. And I must say that my daughter, Nicole, having very limited experience with a baseball or a baseball glove, or a tennis ball for all that matter, she did pretty well. She's got a pretty good arm. She has a little problem watching the ball all the way into the glove. I have to work on that. But we were having a pretty good time, and she was acquitting herself in a very respectable manner. And one of her friends, did I say friend again? Really just an associate. An associate from the neighborhood. She wasn't very athletic. And it wasn't after too long that she went into the garage of one of the kids next door, and she came out with a soccer ball, and she started kicking that around in the front yard. And we all kind of gave her a look, you know, what's that all about?
You kind of mentioned all the rest of them are boys.
Oh, yeah, everyone else is boys, and just my little 7-year-old girl, and they're all older than her, too. And just my little 7-year-old girl and another girl in the neighborhood who's, what, probably 11-ish or something. She starts kicking the soccer ball around. And, of course, the obvious question is, look, we're sitting here. We've got baseball gloves. We're throwing the ball around. What's the deal with bringing a soccer ball into the equation? And she said, well, you know, that's boring, throwing a baseball. She started kicking the soccer ball around. Anyway, you know, soccer's a game in which, you know, a child can be immersed in the group and very rarely be singled out for individual attention. And so that intimidates a lot of the younger set who have a problem with their self-esteem. It's very precariously balanced in their lives, and it could crash and burn at any moment. And at that moment, they run and grab a soccer ball. But anyway, now why did I bring that up? Well, my wife gave me a letter that we got over this past week from a... The National Miss Teen Denver pageant is apparently set to launch here in the greater metro area. We got a letter from Ann Klenowski, the coordinator for this year's 2009 Miss Teen Denver pageant. She says, "You've been referred to me as having a daughter between the ages of 7 and 19 within your family who may enjoy modeling in front of an audience and learning modeling routines that enable her to accomplish her goals on stage. And I'm just thinking, okay, you obviously don't know who we are. And you know, what little girl doesn't have some ambition to be in a beauty pageant or to be an actress or to be a singer or to be famous in some respect? They all have that immature urge. And we have to, well, not beat it out of them, but we have to educate them beyond that foolish, silly, stupid urge. And so, what does she say? Oh, she says here in her letter, no past experience is necessary and training will be provided for the Miss Teen Denver pageant. We're going to keep working on the baseball around the house here. We're not going to, about which our daughter will have no illusions that she may someday play Major League Baseball or even Minor League Baseball. But we're certainly not going to let her get tangled up in the Miss Teen Denver Nationals pageant. Although, there's no doubt in my mind that she could win it hands down if indeed that effort were made. But the offer must be rebuffed. Okay. So now let's move on to the more important and significant news of the day, if that is the case. And I suppose I will let you decide. I'm not sure there is anything more momentous than what's happening in my little corner of the world, my little circle of influence, my little family. Here, let me dive into the All-American file to launch the broadcast, to launch the new segment of the broadcast. This is from Billings, Montana, from the Associated Press. Dustin Britton, a 32-year-old mechanic and ex-Marine from Windsor, Colorado, said he was alone cutting firewood about 100 feet from his campsite in the Shoshone National Forest when he saw a 100-pound mountain lion staring at him from some bushes. Now, the 6-foot-tall, 170-pound Britton said he raised his 18-inch chainsaw and met the lion head-on as it pounced, a collision he described as feeling like a grown man running directly into him. He says, the mountain lion batted me 3 or 4 times with its front paws. As quick as I hit it with the saw, it turned away. Now this is an American man. Now I don't know if this story got wide play in the highly sensitive, highly feminized news media. If it did, I'm sure there was plenty of whining and crying for the mountain lion. But here on The Worldview, we acknowledge when real Americans, an ex-Marine to boot, takes a chainsaw to a mountain lion. The AP reports that the mountain lion was shot and killed after it attacked a dog brought in to track the animal. They say the animal was 4 to 5 years old, and it was in poor condition and apparently starving. Now, I'm not going to say that if I were... You know, I could be watching one of those nature shows where they're telling us the life story of the mountain lion, and I could get kind of involved in the mountain lion's life, and he's having a rough time. He hasn't eaten in a few days. But at the end of the day, when the ex-Marine whips out the chainsaw, I just have to come down on his side. I'm sorry. I don't know what the deal is with liberals. They seem to love mountain lions and wolves. I'm not sure I understand that. They're obviously a self-destructive lot. We spent the better part of the 20th century ridding North America of mountain lions and wolves, and now they want to reintroduce them so that we have more incidents where mountain lions and wolves are attacking people. And what can you say to that? Thank heavens for the United States Marine Corps. Good night, Smedley Butler. Good night, Dan Daly. And thankfully, that Marine Corps training, that good old Marine Corps training, came in handy for that studly American up there in Montana. He was from Colorado, ex-Marine. What a great story. That's from the All-American file. All right, now, in order to start the show off in the right mood, put everyone in a good mood, let's go to the justice file. It's rather thin this week, but there is some good news. Dateline Lucasville, Ohio, from the Associated Press, a former Oregon truck driver who went on a multi-state killing spree declined to make a final statement before being executed in an Ohio prison. Can we get a round of applause? We're going to have to get some audio tape of a round of applause. That way we can do that for every execution. And unfortunately, they're few and far between. While the murders and the bloodshed and the blood running through the streets of America is something that you can report on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis, if one chooses to do so, the executions are few and far between, but we want to applaud the officials there in Ohio who finally pulled this off. John Fountainberry shook his head and said no when technicians asked him whether he wanted to say any final words. He was sentenced to death for killing Joseph Darren Jr., who picked him up hitchhiking east of Cincinnati way back in 1991. Darren pleaded for his life before Fountainberry shot him and threw his body into a wooded area near the Ohio River. The victim's daughter, Rachel, who was 4 years old when her father was murdered, attended the execution with her mother. The 22-year-old young woman said she wished the execution had come sooner, but she did not expect to hear any last words from Fountainberry. She says, "I know he's not sorry, he didn't care, and even if he did, it's not going to bring my dad back or any of the other victims back." Fountainberry died, by the way, by a quite comfy, soft, and gentle application of drugs via lethal injection at the Southern Ohio Correction Facility. An interesting note on this story, Fountainberry, the killer, the madman murderer, had given up his right to a trial by a jury in Cincinnati and pleaded no contest as early as July of 1992 to two counts of aggravated murder and other charges, and it still took 17 years for the state of Ohio to execute this bastard. What is going on with the justice system? It's just embarrassing, but we'll take the good news wherever we can in these dark days as we witness the decline and fall of Western civilization and all that is good and righteous. Good work in Ohio, a little long in coming, but good work nonetheless. Now, from Ohio, let's jump into the international file, because this is just weird, okay? Just a weird story, and I'm not sure where it's going. Dateline Colmar, France, from the Associated Press. Two Tour de France cyclists were slightly injured Friday in what their team suspect was an air rifle shooting. Yeah, New Zealand's Julian Dean and Spain's Oscar Freire were struck while riding on their bicycles in the northeast of France during the 13th stage of the famous Tour de France. They believe an air rifle was used. One projectile was removed from one of the cyclist's cleanly shaven thighs. So you wonder what's going on. Now, this reminds me of a story. When I was in the service, we were manly men back then. And this was before don't ask, don't tell, don't seek, don't smile, don't smell policy. And we did not care for queers, frankly. And we were fairly vocal about it. It wasn't something we hid. We were all staunchly heterosexual, and we expected that the man next to us in the foxhole, or, well, in my case, I'd never really spent any time in the foxhole, the man next to me on the radio set would be as staunchly heterosexual as we were. And a new fellow was transferred to our unit, and the very first morning of this new fellow's tour of duty there in Okinawa, there at Futenma Air Station, with the mighty 1st Marine Air Wing of the United States Marine Corps, hoorah, his very first day, there are maybe a half dozen of us in there showering together, something you could do back in the 80s. We could all shower together without worrying about, I'll just move on. Anyway, he comes in, and he steps into the shower amongst a half dozen staunchly heterosexual Marines. He takes out his shaving cream and begins to shave his legs right in front of us. So we were all taken aback, needless to say. Well, turns out he was a cyclist. Yes, he rode bicycles in competitive racing situations. And he said that he had to shave the hair off his body so that when he took a fall on the road, that the hair would not be gripped by the asphalt and tear flesh away from his body. A likely story, right? Well, it proved out that he was heterosexual, as far as we all knew. I mean, there was no there was some evidence of some strange characteristics, but turned out to be a pretty good fellow and a decent Marine. Yeah, and he listened to that new wave music too. Anyone who listened to music where there were no guitars and there were only synthesizers and men with makeup, that always concerned us. But anyway. Yeah, that was the 80s. What are you going to do? Anyway, what happened? Now, let's get back to the story of the Tour de France. What happened here? Is it deranged fans? You know, kids whose brains are just modeled after playing video games all day. They think it's a game. They're going to take their air rifles out and shoot, try to pick off Tour de France racers. Just some black-hearted teenagers out there. I just don't know. Possibly. It's quite possible that it was just ordinary drivers looking to send a message to all of you people on bicycles that we're sick of you getting in front of us in traffic. No, I just don't know what's going on there. But it brings to mind the prediction that a prophet that I know made, a prediction that eventually, within our lifetime, a professional athlete will be shot and killed on the field of competition. And here, they were shot. They were not killed, thank heavens. But it just another signal that the world is becoming deranged. And we're going to get into exactly why as we go through the broadcast today. And I'm going to have to pick up the pace because I do have a large compilation, body of work from the week. And so we need to really jump into it. Let's jump into the culture file. From the Washington Post, Jane Roe was arrested at the Supreme Court hearing. The woman at the center of the Supreme Court's landmark abortion rights ruling was arrested at the confirmation hearing for one Sonia, spelled without a J, Sotomayor, among a wave of anti-abortion protesters who lined the sidewalks outside the Senate office building, and several of whom made it into the hearing room and disrupted in an attempt to disrupt the proceedings. That's what the Washington Post wrote. And disrupted in an attempt to disrupt the proceedings. I'm just reading the news as it was printed in the Washington Post. Okay, so all these years at journalism school, apparently they didn't spend a whole lot of time on proper grammar, spelling and things like that. Anyway, there are a number of typos in the story. I'm going to move past them, okay, because I don't want to muddy the waters. I want you to get the gist of the story. Norma McCorvey, better known as Jane Roe during the Roe v. Wade case, her pursuit, you'll remember, of the right to access to abortion in the early 1970s led to the ruling that has been a pivotal part of every Supreme Court nomination process. And she it says she eventually become a notable opponent of abortion. So they meant to say she eventually became a notable opponent of the procedure. But they hate to talk about Norma McCorvey in the present tense. And so they would like to imagine that she simply vanished from the face of the earth, when the fact is that she came to a knowledge of her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ and repented of the sin of abortion, and she actively fights abortion. McCorvey and her friend Frances Mahoney, a 68-year-old woman from Florida, were charged with unlawful conduct for disrupting Congress. Yeah. How that could be considered unlawful, I just do not understand, especially when they're about to elevate to the Supreme Court a woman who is, say what you will about her politics, she comes off as fairly stupid. That's all. She just doesn't come off as the brightest bulb in the room, and she's admitted she's a product. She's admitted. Yes, she has admitted that she's a product of affirmative action. And this is what you get. A relatively dim-witted, middle-aged, angry divorcee who ends up on the Supreme Court doing her part to destroy all that's good and righteous and all she can to do to destroy Western civilization. That's what affirmative action has produced for us. Norma McCorvey and her friend Mahoney were a part of a group, according to the AP, that were headed out of the hearing room as Al Franken, the latest comedian in the Senate, was praising the service of Senator Edward M. Kennedy, a staunch supporter of killing unborn children. And I imagine they may not have even planned to disrupt the service, but to hear Al Franken praising Senator Edward Kennedy while Sonia Sotomayor is sitting there in the room, I think that perhaps they were just overcome with disbelief that we could have come to this point in the history of our nation, and McCorvey and Mahoney just had to stand up and scream because they're just being driven mad by the state of things in the political culture in our country. Let's see. So Edward M. Kennedy, he hasn't been there. And so apparently Al Franken is going to step into the empty suit of Edward M. Kennedy. I guess that's what we've got to look forward to. I want to thank Norma McCorvey and her good friend Francis Mahoney for disrupting Al Franken. Franklin? Alf? Whatever his name is. Alf. You know, and I just want to, on this story, is this not more evidence that we are living in a state of suspended disbelief? Jane Roe, the very Jane Roe of the Roe v. Wade decision that the abortion rights proponents worship. They worship this ruling as if it were handed down on the mountain to Moses. The woman herself is now pro-life. She's anti-abortion. She's actively working against child killing every day of her life. And she's ignored by the major media. This is a major story. Her conversion should have shaken the foundations of the abortion industry. But the news media ignores it. And you know, political correctness is a state, is an affliction under which the masses, the majority, the great masses of the population are forced by cultural pressures to deny the obvious on a daily basis. And it must be so often denied that the results eventually are mental illness, nay, possibly even madness. Yeah, at least mental illness. Yeah. It's no wonder the pharma companies are working day and night to produce the next antidepressant, the next sleep medication for the deranged population of this nation whose minds are being so corrupted by the politically correct habit we've all been forced into of denying the obvious every day. I know it's driving me insane. And I'm one who doesn't participate in it, the denial of the obvious, at least not at every moment. But that's the state we're in, a state of suspended disbelief. We're forced to suspend our disbelief in the fact that the obvious must be so obviously denied. If it wasn't so dangerous to the future of our nation, it would almost be funny. But it's not really that funny. Do you want to talk about something funny? Let's jump into the culture file. Dateline San Francisco, California, where you can always count on a story of the bizarre, the stupid, the freakish, and relatively entertaining and terrifying at the same time. California tax officials say a state proposal to tax and regulate marijuana like alcohol would generate nearly $1.4 billion in revenue. The bill, introduced by San Francisco Democrat Assemblyman Tom Amiano in between bong hits back in February, would allow adults to legally possess, grow, and sell marijuana. Amiano has promoted the bill as a way to help bridge the state's $26 billion budget shortfall. Did you folks do the math on that? He wants to bridge the $26 billion shortfall by raising $1 billion selling pot to the children of California. So, Mr. Amiano, number one, it really just doesn't add up. $1 billion from selling marijuana to the children of California is not going to help with your $26 billion problem. But it's not really about the money, is it? It's about the fact that Mr. Amiano, along with other Democratic politicians, want as many young teenage girls as stoned as possible. And, well, in their case, boys as well. I mean, this is San Francisco. So that they can take advantage of them and corrupt them. That's what it's really about. They want to take advantage of the children and corrupt them. And one good way to do that is to make sure they're all stoned on marijuana. That's what this is really about. It's not about the budget shortfall. Now, the AP tells us that as the bill is written, the state could not begin collecting taxes on marijuana until the federal government legalizes marijuana. He says he wants to change the bill to get rid of that stipulation. Anyway, I think it's not too far off before the federal government does legalize marijuana, for crying out loud. I mean, they'll do anything to hide the fact from us that they're destroying the country. And I suppose if they can get everybody smoking marijuana and be good and stoned all the time, that we won't notice that they've destroyed our country and Western civilization in general. Just disturbing news out of California. Disturbing news out of San Francisco. Less disturbing news, but big this week, I suppose. Walter Cronkite has gone on to his reward, and I'm sure he's being rewarded for his works at this very moment. You'll remember he was called the most trusted man in America. And CBS, this is a story off the CBS website. At one time, CBS reports, Walter Cronkite's audience was so large and his image so credible that a 1972 poll determined he was the most trusted man in America, surpassing even the president, vice president, and members of Congress, and all other journalists. In a time of turmoil and mistrust, after Vietnam and Watergate, the title was a rare feat and the label stuck. Yes, Walter Cronkite went to his grave known as the most trusted man in America. And it turns out that the most trusted man in America was not all that trustworthy. I noticed it somewhere around 1988 when I heard a quite impassioned speech that Mr. Cronkite gave in favor of teaching evolution in our schools. And the fact that a man considered so intelligent, so professional, and so trusted could be sucked in by a fairy tale like the evolutionary fairy tale of Charles Darwin, it struck me. Even though at the time I was less than serving the Lord, let's say, in 1988, I was not on board with Jesus Christ or salvation. But even I knew that a fairy tale that ridiculous as evolution, If one were to purport that it was true, certainly did not elevate one to be called the most trusted man in America. And at the age of 92, we can admit that, Walter Cronkite was given every opportunity to realize the truth, but instead went to his grave in a state of suspended disbelief. Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome to the second half of the broadcast as we close in on broadcast journalism history. Now that Walter Cronkite has faded from the scene, I will obviously escalate to my to my place of media dominance. I was just waiting for him to get out of the way. The gray glass ceiling has been removed. All right, let's go now deeper into the culture file. We'll go to Fort Worth, Texas, and a fairly disturbing story. Fort Worth's mayor has apologized for a June raid on a Texas gay bar that sparked claims of brutality and procedure violations. Now, a gay bar, for those of you who are less than initiated into the devolution of our culture, is not a bar where everybody's happy. No, it's just the opposite, as a matter of fact. Apparently, the Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission and the Fort Worth Police Department executed a raid, Stonewall style, against a bar there in the Fort Worth area. And now the mayor is apologizing, falling all over himself, apologizing to the homosexuals who are basically responsible for destroying themselves and the world around them. They're forced to apologize because we are all living in a state where we have to suspend our knowledge of what is obviously true, that gay bars are extremely destructive, disgusting, depressing, life-destroying places. We have to deny all that, even though it's obviously true, day in and day out. We have to deny that. And if for whatever reason something happens at a gay bar that might possibly offend someone in the homosexual community, we have to fall all over ourselves and apologize to prove how sensitive and culturally aware we are and how progressively minded we are. The Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission and the Fort Worth Police Department are investigating the raid, which they conducted jointly. And you know what bothers me is here you've got deviant men committing the most heinous crimes against each other, against God, and against society in general, and the inept bozo officials in the Fort Worth area are cracking skulls over possible liquor license violations. You know, someone needs to go to these dens of iniquity, these homosexual bars, and let these people know that they're destroying themselves. And we don't care if your liquor license is in order. We don't care if you're keeping within the noise ordinance of the community. You're destroying each other, and the pervasive nature of your political ambitions are seeking to destroy our children, and we're simply not going to let it happen anymore. I mean, would you want a gay bar in your neighborhood? anyway. But the focus of law enforcement is simply being placed in the wrong. And I suppose that bringing the homosexuals to repentance is the place of the church, not necessarily the police. Although, if as it has been for several thousand years, if homosexuality was a crime, as it has been until just recently, well, it would be the job of the police to rouse these deviants off the streets so they could at least do less damage to each other and the society at large. And then let the church do its work. But the law has to do its work first. Can I get a witness? All right, now. Oh, this is... Okay, let's dive into this story in the culture file from the Ukraine. From the French press agency, Ukraine has banned the hit comedy Bruno on the grounds that it could have a damaging effect on Ukrainians' moral health. Hallelujah to the Ukrainians. I mean, 70 years under the Soviet boot did not destroy at least clear reasoning in the minds of some of Ukraine's governing officials. We're glad to see that. Now, the film, which you may or may not be aware of, it stars Sacha Baron Cohen, an alleged comedian. He plays a gay Austrian fashionista with a habit of making outrageous remarks. It is the top movie, apparently, here in the North American box office. I mean, surely the end is near, right? I mean, this deviant, creep, disgusting, make you want to puke comedian has the number one movie in North America. I mean, surely the end is near. Anyway, but on a positive note, the Ukrainian Ministry of Culture has decided to ban all showings of this film on Ukrainian territory. The Ministry of Culture released a letter to a Ukrainian film distributor, and the Ukrainian said, "The film contains unjustified showing of perversion in an explicitly realistic manner and sadistic manifestations which could damage the morality of our citizens. We will not tolerate it here in Ukraine." And congratulations to the Ukrainians. There's something else in here, but I don't care. Yeah, okay, Sacha Baron Cohen. It seems like Matt Drudge can't do a 24-hour period without having at least one story about this comedian, which I don't know what that means, but it makes me worry about Matt Drudge, frankly. I myself have never witnessed any of Sacha Baron Cohen's movies, nor shall I. but congratulations, and maybe we have to go to the Ukraine to escape this state of suppression that we're under, in which we have to deny the obvious. We have to celebrate Sacha Baron Cohen as a genius comedian of his generation, rather than a low-life, deviant, crotch comedian who's obviously obsessed with deviant male behavior. Let me just put it that way so it's in a relatively family-friendly manner. Let's continue with the culture file. Dateline Detroit, Michigan, from the Associated Press. A Michigan appeals court overturned a ruling on Wednesday that had sent a minister to prison for 6 months after he had warned a judge that he could be tortured by God. Preach it, my brother. Let's see, the Right Reverend Edward Pinckney. Edward Pinckney wrote a commentary in a Chicago-based populist newspaper that said Judge Alfred Butzbaugh could be punished by God with curses, fever, and extreme burning unless he repented. Oh, yeah. The black minister also described Butzbaugh as a dumb racist and corrupt. Now, the racist part, I don't know. But if he's a judge, you can bet he's dumb. I mean, look at Sonia Sotomayor. He can obviously be a judge and be relatively stupid. And the corruption, well, that goes without saying. But apparently, the courts were quite upset that he would invoke punishment from God above on a judge who, I mean, in the judicial system, certainly a judge is considered to be several notches above God. So how dare he even suggest that there could be some punishment for the justices who are carrying out the injustices that are destroying the country. They were quite mad at him. But he has been, the conviction's been overturned. He says this is a thrilling victory, one for the people. He said from his home in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Oh, my goodness. Benton Harbor, Michigan is like Kabul West. I mean, it looks like it's been in a civil war for 20 years. And in fact, to some degree, it certainly has. But the Right Reverend apparently lives there. He says, I'm so happy. I don't even know what to tell you. And the American Civil Liberties Union represented him in the appeal, as they're so wont to do. And they welcome the decision. We have a quote here from Michael Steinberg, legal director at the ACLU of Michigan. He says, quote, to our knowledge, this case marks the first time in modern history that a preacher has been thrown in prison for predicting what God might do. Now, we don't know if Mr. Steinberg is homosexual, but he is a director of the ACLU in Michigan, so, you know, pretty much follows. It's just a guess on my part, but it's an educated guess. Pinckney, by the way, the Right Reverend Edward Pinckney, has been on house arrest with an electronic tether since this December passed when the appeals court released him while considering his case. While in prison in 2008, he received 3,500 votes as the Green Party candidate for Congress in Michigan's 6th District. The Green Party? Oh, man. Here I am all set to like this guy. And turns out he's a Green Party candidate. Well, I tell you. I suppose when you're in Benton Harbor, you know, there's a certain level of desperation. And so even the Green Party is able to recruit candidates for office out of Benton Harbor, Michigan. Also, the Right Reverend knocks himself down a couple of notches in our book. But we do appreciate the fact that he did let a judge know that, hey, judge, God is watching you. And so there. All right. Let's move deeper into the culture file. If we could get mired any more deeply. Dateline New York City from the Associated Press. Episcopalians declared gays and lesbians eligible for any ordained ministry this past week in a vote of their committee on how to upset the Creator God. I'm not sure what they call this committee. But the Episcopal General Convention, okay, it met in Anaheim, California. They gave final approval to a measure during their legislative assembly there to basically ordain anything. Are you gay? Are you bisexual? Are you transgendered? Do you have an unnatural relationship with a farm animal? You're eligible for the ministry. Come on board. I mean, hey, we're Episcopalians. We're on our way pretty much straight to hell with jet rockets as it is. We might as well invite the queers in so that at least the place is decorated well. I don't know what these people are thinking about. Let's see there. What did they vote on here? It says, God has called and may call gays in committed relationships to any ordained ministry in the church. That's what the resolution says. John Cheek, I said John Cheek, who is a delegate from the Diocese of Western Massachusetts. He said, I personally believe we had to do this. It's the way we see the gospel. Yeah. I mean, folks, this is the third largest denomination in the world, and they've gone queer. I mean, is this not more evidence that this is willful ignorance of the obvious? A willful disregard for that which is obvious. Homosexuals do not belong in the pulpit, my dear Episcopalian brethren and sistren, and whatever other ends you got there now, because you seem to be letting everybody in. Anyway, so there goes the Episcopalians. We can put them in the handbasket on their way to hell. The Episcopalians have acquitted themselves not so well. All right, now, to continue into the culture file to see if we can possibly lift ourselves out of the mire of that story, and I'm not sure we can. Let's go over to England. A BBC conductor, Britain's greatest conductor, a living conductor, and his wife have taken their own lives in the Swiss-assisted suicide clinic in Dignitas. In Switzerland, according to the BBC, Sir Edward Downes, 85 years old, and his 74-year-old wife Joan traveled there to end their lives just over this past week. Sir Edward had suffered with near blindness for the past 15 years, and he was going deaf. Lady Downes had terminal cancer, and he decided he could not go on living without her, and they decided to fly to an assisted suicide clinic in Dignitas, Switzerland, and apparently have taken their own lives. According to the BBC, at least 115 Britons are believed to have taken their lives there at the clinic there in Dignitas. And that doesn't bode well for the future of Britannia, does it? I mean, what's going on in England? This is one of their leading cultural icons. Or at least he was, you know, 40 years ago when people cared about conductors. But you know, he's a symbol of British culture, and he's taken his own life along with his wife there in Switzerland. A statement released by their son and daughter said the couple died on July 10th under circumstances of their own choosing. Our parents had no religious beliefs, they said, and there will be no funeral. The couple's children added that they will also be missed by their grandchildren, Omar and Zeki. So this is really emblematic of the state of Britannia in general. The older generation that represents British culture, they're killing themselves, and Omar is ascending. Omar is on the rise in Britain. A sad story. It's sad to see a culture that has been so entwined with the history of the United States, a culture like Britain, stumbling so badly as they get so close to the end of the race. I hear you, Stevie. And don't give up on love, but you may want to give up on Britain, as sad as that might be. Tell me about it, Stevie. Tell me it hurts, brother, don't it? What a shame, what a shame. That hurts. All right, now let's jump into the domestic tranquility file. We're going to have to go quickly to try to get through all the stories this week. Dateline New York. From the Associated Press, Lucille Hamilton paid $261 to have her spiritual grime removed by a voodoo high priest in a townhouse on a winding street in Camden County. I'm sorry, the dateline here was London. I apologize. In England. Oh, here we go again. England. Hamilton was a 21-year-old male living as a woman. Okay, well, there you go. Flew in on Friday from its home. They say her home. Flew in on Friday from its home near Little Rock, Arkansas, to the house on there in Gloucester Township. Friend said she flew in to take part in a three-day spiritual cleansing session referred to on the Voodoo Priest's website there. By Saturday night, Hamilton was dead. Her boss said Hamilton was a devout Catholic with an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe tattooed on her foot, but was also interested in voodoo, if you can imagine that. I mean, people with Lady of Guadalupe statues and tattoos, I can see how they could get into voodoo. It's all very similar. Now, the voodoo priest identifies himself as Hungan Hector on his website. He claims he was initiated as a senior priest in Haiti, and that the ceremony she was involved in, the victim was involved in, quote, improves the ability for possession, clears the mind, clarifies abilities for seeing, and substantially improves the life. Well, not in this case particularly, but he's saying overall that this voodoo cleansing ritual improves the life. Let's this story aside, obviously. Again, willful ignorance of the obvious. Back in the domestic tranquility file, Dateline Washington from the Associated Press. A woman accused of killing her four daughters told police in an interview that the girls were possessed by demons. Yeah, the decomposing bodies of Benita Jack's daughters, ages 5 to 17, were discovered in January 2008 when U.S. Marshals came to evict her from her Southeast Washington home. Jack's lawyers have urged her to use an insanity defense, but she has refused, and a judge has found her competent to stand trial. We don't know how, if that judge is competent. Chances are he or she or it is not. This deranged woman said that her eldest daughter Brittany was possessed by a demon she called Jezebel. Authorities have said that Brittany was stabbed to death, while the other young girls were strangled. Jack says she had nothing to do with their deaths. She told detectives that her daughters inexplicably died one by one in their sleep. It wasn't me, she said when police questioned her. So it's like the Bart Simpson defense. They died in their sleep. Okay, what about the stab wounds? It wasn't me. Unbelievable. And what a tragedy. Bad religion, folks. Bad religion kills.
Who was possessed by
the
devil?
Who was possessed? She claims it was the daughters. That is open to some debate as to who was possessed there. A Dateline Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Brandon Mueller, 36-year-old man, along with his mother, Nancy Pino, and their friend, Donald Worth, were jailed after investigators found bone fragments in a burn barrel on Worth's property. All are accused in the death of Renee Redmer, a young mother reported missing this past January. They all face charges of assisting a felon and helping mutilate a corpse. They could face up to nearly 17 years in prison. I'm just reading the news as the AP types it out. They could face up to nearly 17 years in prison and a $45,000 fine. Well, okay, so the writing isn't so good with the Associated Press, but what a creative sentence. You know, you help someone chop up a body and dispose of it. Let's see. 17 years and $45,000 fine. What a creative sentence. Not very effective, but very creative on the part of the folks there in Milwaukee. Dateline Hagerstown, Maryland. Maryland jurors have convicted a 16-year-old girl of soliciting the killing of her father, who was stabbed to death outside the family's home on Halloween. This is the domestic tranquility file, by the way. It's not the justice file. I know she was convicted, but wait. The Washington County Circuit Court deliberated for about 90 minutes before finding Danielle Black guilty of solicitation of first-degree murder. She faces up to life in prison when she is sentenced. The girl contends she only wanted her father roughed up and not killed. Police haven't been able to verify her claims of abuse. Of course, she claims she was abused, and that's why she solicited the murder of her father. Solicitation of murder is murder. She should not be facing life in prison. She should be facing the death penalty swiftly and painfully, but she is not, because we are living in a culture that is forced daily to suspend disbelief and dismiss the obvious. A girl solicits someone to kill her father, she should be executed. Nope, we have to suspend that. We're not allowed to say that. And we've been doing it so long that I think collectively we're going mad. Dateline Chicago from CBS. Three men were fatally shot. One man was fatally stabbed. Police shot one man, and at least seven other people were wounded by gunfire, including an eight-year-old boy sitting in his bedroom during an especially violent six-hour period late last Wednesday into early last Thursday on the south and west side of Chicago. Hey, isn't Barry Ho from Chicago? He seems to have left quite a mess there. I mean, we need a surge in Chicago. We need to send General Petraeus to the south side, for crying out loud. I mean, was Barry involved in what's in governance in Chicago to some degree? I believe he was. What a mess he left there. Dateline Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 17-year-old boy from suburban Pittsburgh who police say tried to kill his sleeping family last fall by placing a homemade bomb in their beds will be tried in juvenile court. The bombs didn't go off. No one was hurt. And Judge Anthony Mariani, in his eminent wisdom, has decided to try this potential murderer as a juvenile so that he'll never spend much more time in... he'll never face execution. Of course, it's Pittsburgh. He probably wouldn't have anyways. Putting a bomb under someone's bed, that is attempted murder, which is the same as murder in the eyes of the law, and he should be executed. Do I want to do any more from... I can't do the story from the Domestic Tranquility file because it's just going to depress me. Let's move on to the politics file. Joe Biden told people attending an AARP town hall meeting that unless the Democrats-supported health care plan becomes law, the nation will go bankrupt, and the only way to avoid that fate is for the government to spend more money. He said, folks, look. Joe Biden... Folks, look, AARP knows, and the people with me here today know, the president knows, and I know, that the status quo is simply not acceptable. It's totally unacceptable, and it's completely unsustainable. Even if we wanted to keep it the way we have it now, we can't do it financially. We're going to bankrupt the nation, Joe Biden said. Finally speaking the truth, we are going to bankrupt the nation like a broken clock, you know. Even a broken clock is right once a day, twice a day. How does that go? Joe Biden is like a very, very dimly lit broken clock. So the event was sponsored by the AARP, Ancient Americans Robbing People. The AARP members were bussed in for the meeting. It's like a weekend at Atlantic City. I can see the geezers getting off the bus. Wait a minute. Where's the casino? What do you mean, Joe Biden? What is this? Do we have to buy tickets? Oh, the tickets are free? And there's an early bird dinner afterward. All right, fine. Let's go see Biden. Anyway, let's see here. Do we have any more quotes from Biden? Let's see. He's talking about the healthcare proposal. Biden says, there'll be a deal in there. There'll be a deal in there so there's competition, you see. So what you'll have in there is you'll have the ability to go in there and say, now look, this is the insurance policy I want. This is the one. And those people who can't afford to get in there up to a certain income, we're going to subsidize them. You get in there and we'll help you pay for it. Unquote. Joe, I mean, here's a graveyard. Could you just get in there? I mean, we'd all sleep better tonight if Joe Biden would just pass from the scene, please. And I don't generally wish death on anyone, but speaking of that, a new book by Senator Edward M. Kennedy, his publishing house is going to issue a limited edition book, and they plan to sell it for $1,000 a copy. Yes, according to the Boston Globe, the publisher is planning to issue 1,000 copies of a leather-bound, electronically signed edition of Kennedy's book called True Compass and sell it through a website. Yeah. Edward M. Kennedy's book is called True Compass. That must be the compass that was lacking in the Buick that he drove into the river when he killed that girl back in 1968. I'm not sure what that's all about. Anyway, Kennedy is 77 years old. Unfortunately, he's still alive. And he reportedly received an $8 million advance for the memoir that was written for him by Ron Powers, the actual author. The publisher is now planning to release the regular hardcover edition in October with a retail list price of $35, and they're planning an initial run of 1.5 million copies, most of which, no doubt, will end up in Edward M. Kennedy's basement. I know I'm not buying the book. Is that the end of the show? Well, I want to thank all my friends at American Right to Life, my good friends at KGOV.com Radio, Denver Bible Church, Personhood USA, and the great work they're doing, and all my brethren out at Theology Online, and of course my other brother Daryl, who helps make it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios in beautiful Denver, Colorado. Ladies and gentlemen, as you go forward into this week, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.